You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 2nd of June 2020 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist coming to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead...
If a city or state refuses to take the actions that are necessary to defend the life and property of their residents, then I will deploy the United States military and quickly solve the problem for them.
America is burning. We'll get the latest from the worst race riot since the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. And hear from Minneapolis, scene of the murder of George Floyd. Britain's Parliament is now meeting in person, but many schools have rejected the permission to restart. We'll examine the latest reaction to the COVID-19 crisis in a not-so-united kingdom. But for some, the pandemic is an opportunity. Wizz Air is pressing ahead with providing services when other airlines are still grounded. But will it provoke a second wave? In South Korea, which seemed to have had a firm handle on the disease, another lockdown is now in place. We'll cross to Seoul to find out more. Plus, we get the latest business news, have a look through the front pages, no prizes for guessing what makes the cut, and...
We involve JR, the street artist. Then we ask Oscar-winning director Paolo Sorrentino to direct himself a magazine like it was a movie. And you know what? On one end, it was incredible, and in my opinion, it's a miracle.
We hear from the editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair, Italy. Yes, there is still beauty and fashion in the world. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. The death of George Floyd, an African-American man whose murder has set off nationwide unrest in the US, has been declared a homicide following an official post-mortem examination. Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam has accused foreign governments of double standards in their reaction to Beijing's plans to impose national security laws on the city, pointing to anti-police brutality protests in the United States. And Japan's government has approved saliva-based testing for COVID-19, hoping to boost the number of tests being carried out. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, more than a week after the murder of George Floyd at the hands of police in Minneapolis, the crisis gripping America continues to intensify and create division. As demonstrators defy curfews and call for real action against racism and police brutality, President Donald Trump continues to lash out at demonstrators and at state governors. We'll get more on Trump's divisive law and order at all costs approach with Jeffrey Howard in a moment. But first, what's it like living in Minneapolis, scene of the death of George Floyd and where the protests that have rocked many of the US cities originated? And what if you work for City Hall trying to achieve racial equality? Our America's editor-at-large, Ed Stocker, spoke to Minneapolis's director of the Division of Race and Equality, Joyce Stevens, about her thoughts on the last week in the Minnesotan city and throughout the US, and how the nation may be able to heal in the future.
When I think about the scenes in Minneapolis, as I travel through the city, both on the south side, which is where George Floyd was murdered, and on the north side, where I've spent a significant amount of time this past weekend connecting residents to resources, what I see is a lot of damage to properties that have been a part of my life for most of my life. And that is shocking. I've been led to tears. I've been quite emotional at those locations and seeing what I've been seeing. And not so much because of the loss of property, which is certainly significant, but the expression of that and what that symbolizes of the deep pain that our communities are experiencing right now and the centuries of struggle between particularly the Black community and policing as an institution and seeing that on full display, just the deep pain of that and the trauma around that. That's what I'm seeing, and that's deeply shocking. What I'm also seeing is people across our city really responding to the pain in ways that are very healing and very comforting, and in the ways in which they are coming out after nights of protest and cleaning up the streets, the ways in which they're reaching into their resource to provide resource to those who now don't have the same access to either transportation or to grocery stores or to medical supplies within their community. I'm seeing a whole range of both beauty and hope and love and generosity, as well as deep pain.
I mean, obviously, this all started with the death, as you mentioned, in Minneapolis of George Floyd. But obviously, this is a problem that has been around for a very long time in America. And it seems that perhaps anger and frustration about that has been coming out. Can you explain from your viewpoint what injustice people, especially people of color in America, are feeling at the moment?
The sense of injustice that Black people are experiencing, and I'll speak specifically of Black people, not because I'm a Black woman, I'm not trying to represent Blackness, but that's the moment that we're in, and we're really looking at the results of that state-sanctioned violence against Black bodies on full display. I will say that the injustice that we are responding to as a people is not new. It didn't just start with George Floyd's murder, but it has been a part of our nation for over 400 years, you know, since we came against our will in slave ships to the Americas, there has been violence against the Black body. And what we're seeing is the expression of deep, deep trauma.
I mean, your job in Minneapolis is centered around gender and race equity. How far does the US, and of course the city where you are itself, have to travel? How far off equity is the US and Minneapolis?
We are very far off. When I think about Minneapolis in particular, Minnesota, we have some of the worst outcomes when it relates to social and economic measures of progress for Black people than any other place in the nation. We as a state enjoy a reputation of being very progressive and being very advanced around racial equity. And I would say that there are reasons why we have that reputation and that we've earned that reputation. But at the same time, when we look at the lived experiences of Black people in Minneapolis, specifically in Minnesota statewide, it's quite stark. It's very hard to be a Black person in Minneapolis when it comes to how much money you're going to make on your job and how much wealth you can accumulate for your family, what your educational outcomes will look like, what your health outcomes will look like. It's very, very hard to be Black in Minnesota. And we're representative of Blackness across the nation. I would say that we have a very, very long road to go if we're actually looking to building a more equitable economy, a more equitable society where it doesn't matter what race or ethnicity with which you identify, which culture you are a part of, you can have the same outcomes as anyone else, regardless.
How confident are you that something will change this time around? Because this isn't the first time we've seen Black people dying at the hands of white police officers. Do you think this time will be any different?
I would say I think a lot of things about this moment. When George Floyd, when we first heard of his murder, when we first as a team, so I lead a team of people in the city, when we first came together that morning after and began to reflect upon that event, and I will say that the initial moment was very stark and very hopeless. We do this work every single day to try to advance equity inside of our city and to see, despite all of our hard work, despite our investment of both time and financial resource, to be very much in the same place with George Floyd's murder as we were almost 5 years ago with Jamar Clark's murder at the hands of police as well. There was a very stark moment of hopelessness. When I fast forward a week later, that pain is still there. We've not separated ourselves from the pain and the difficulty of trying to measure our work and the effectiveness of our work and the reason in finding value and purpose in it. But at the same time, what we're seeing that's very different and very unique is just how much international outcry there is. Where I find hope is I believe that in this moment, because there is so much outcry, so much attention to what's happening, and so many people across the world who are finding a sense of connection with what happened with George Floyd's murder, with the ways in which community is rising up with the deep pain of that, we are at a time when something definitely can change. If we commit as institutions who espouse values around racial equity as a community of people who say we actually care about Black lives, if we stay the course in elevating the importance of addressing this deep harm and the deep brokenness inside of our systems that leads to outcomes like this, then we absolutely can make a change. It would be devastating to me to have all of this energy and all of this moral rage and all of this attention on this issue happen, and then we get to the other side of it and we find out we're in exactly the same place. That would not only dishonor George Floyd's life, I feel like for every single person who puts their bodies on the line, be they in the movement, be they inside of institutions trying to disrupt from inside, it would put all of that work and all of that effort and just say that it meant nothing. And I would hate to see that happen.
Monocle's Ed Stocker speaking to Joy Stevens there. Well, listening to that with me was Jeffrey Howard, who's a US political expert and a regular Monocle 24 contributor. Good morning to you, Jeffrey. Now, other presidents faced with similar situations have attempted to heal divisions. Trump is going in the other direction. He's threatening violence. He's calling anti-fascist group terrorists. He disappeared into a bunker, issuing incendiary tweets, but he's now come out and made a public appearance. What's the latest from the White House?
Well, yesterday really was one of the most dispiriting days in this whole saga. And I think there were really three key moments yesterday that stood out. So the first was a call that the president had with the nation's governors, in which essentially he encouraged them to increase their use of force against protesters. He said, quote, "You have to get much tougher." He said, "If you don't dominate, you're wasting your time." He said, "They're going to run all over you. You'll look like a bunch of jerks." He called the governors weak, basically goading them to ramp up the amount of force they're using with protesters. He told them that when protesters are throwing rocks, they should treat them as if they're shooting guns, calling for retribution. And so it's not at all surprising that we've seen in some places an escalation of police violence against protesters, because essentially Trump has been explicitly calling for it. And the day got worse from there.
What happened? I mean, he threatened violence on his own people.
So just at the moment when a normal president would have given a speech that brought the nation together, Trump gave his first presidential remarks since the murder of George Floyd and the wave of violent and peaceful protests broke out across countless American streets. And it was not a message of unity. It wasn't a message aimed at turning down the temperature, at bringing people together, at de-escalating the intensity of the situation. It was clearly a speech calculated to whip up anxiety, to increase agitation and anger. It was striking that just before he started giving his speech, they started dispersing peaceful protesters just outside the White House. With tear gas, with rubber bullets. And so what you got on television was a split screen of the president calling for, quote, law and order. And then on the other half of the screen, American citizens running for their lives, I'm sure is how they experienced it. And you can't help but conclude that the president calculated and orchestrated this very moment. He likes this idea of being portrayed as a strong man who can be up there calling for a crackdown on these rabble-rousers as he sees them. Indeed, he's been talking about these protesters as domestic terrorists. And probably the most striking moment of the night was when he invoked the Insurrection Act of 1807, which is an act that gives the president the authority to deploy the military on American soil to resist and crush rebellion. Now, that law, I find it highly unlikely that in the end he will do that. But the fact that he was willing to threaten to deploy the military to attack American citizens protesting was of course, so disturbing.
Jeffrey, do you think that this will have an effect on the election or other protesters, people who would never have voted for Trump anyway? I mean, does it cut across party lines and could it sway those who previously supported him?
I think it certainly could. I think that anyone looking at their television right now and seeing all this can sense that we need a president who can turn down the temperature, who can somehow bring the nation together. And indeed, what's been incredible, I think, is that even though we've had extremely disturbing number of cases of police violence against protesters. We've also been seeing police kneel on the streets, police commissioners take their protective gear off and march with protesters. And that level of engagement between some police and protesters, I think, is indicative that the Black Lives Matter movement has moved the needle. If only incrementally, the moral consciousness of the nation has shifted in such a way. A poll the other day suggested that something like 89% of Americans thought that this attack or this murder of George, this killing of George Floyd, was indeed a crime that should be prosecuted. And those are incredible numbers. And so I think that it seems highly likely that the more moderate, independent-minded voters that took a risk voting for the president last time, who took a risk on this, voting for this businessman on the hope that he'd be able to shake things up and make Washington work for normal American people again, are having a bit of buyer's remorse and thinking that Joe Biden looks like a pretty quiet, easy, safe pair of hands right about now.
Jeffrey, thanks very much indeed. That's Jeffrey Howard there. South Korea has been held up as an example of how to do corona well, but now the country's had to return to stricter lockdown measures. Why has that happened, and is it as bad as it seems? Stephen Borowick, journalist and contributing writer for Nikkei Asian Review, joins me from Seoul now. Stephen, why has the country returned to stricter measures?
Well, there's been a profusion of what they call cluster infections in the Seoul area, which is a really densely populated area where most of the population lives. And there's just this fear that due to the density of these places, that even if you have one case that's unaccounted for, it could spread quite rapidly and it could lead to the need for even more comprehensive lockdown measures. So the government is doing the same things that they've been doing all along now. They've been trying to track people who may have come in contact with a virus carrier, and they're trying to control the spread of the virus as best they can. And they're keeping, over the past several days, they've kept the daily number of infections to around a few dozen. So things have not gotten totally out of control or anything like that. But there is, a few weeks ago, it seemed like there was this sense that the country was ready to emerge from the corona era and kind of move on into this new phase, but that's been delayed. That kind of a declaration of an end to the crisis has definitely been delayed.
And do we know where this new spike came from?
Well, there was a spike a few weeks ago that was in early May that was traced to a young man who visited a bunch of nightclubs in a nightlife area of Seoul, and then him and the people that he came into contact with to kind of dispersed throughout the capital area over the coming weeks. And then just a couple of weeks ago, there was another case that was tied to a distribution center of a very big online delivery company, like the kind of company that Koreans use to order their groceries and clothing and all kinds of other stuff, especially now given the COVID-19 situation. So that was particularly alarming because, you know, the whole purpose of that kind of company is that they have people that visit this distribution center, and then they go out and they visit apartment buildings and businesses and all that. So it's kind of a high risk for spreading there. So the authorities have been doing everything they can to figure out precisely where the initial infection was and then how it spread throughout the country.
Now, the government's announced a new economic recovery plan. Can you give us some of the detail on that?
It's a massive stimulus plan. So the government has already distributed some like one-time relief funds to almost everyone in the country, household, depending on the number of members per household. If you were up to a maximum of 1 million Korean won, which is a little bit less than $1,000 per household. And the rest of it is mostly to prop up kind of ailing but vital industries, like such as SMEs and shipbuilding and auto companies, and really trying to do, the government's trying to do everything they can to limit any kind of job losses. The economy here, even before COVID-19 started, was already in a kind of stagnant growth situation. The government had made restoring the middle class a big priority, and stimulus spending was a big way that they went about that. So this is not, the way that they've handled this is not really a departure from anything that's unusual for them. It's really just a gearing up, a stepping up of what they've been doing otherwise.
And in terms of this new deal, will they also be considering energy efficient ways and green technologies as a means to move forward?
Yes, again, the government here is always very keenly looking for new and promising industries. And over the past couple of years, since the Moon Jae-in administration took power in 2017, they've been really trying to move away from coal and from nuclear power and trying to do everything they can to adjust the country's energy balance away from those sources and towards more green sources of energy. And also, they've been trying to potentially see solar and wind and other renewables as thriving industries that could create growth and could help the country transition away from manufacturing and other kind of old mainstay industries.
Now, we know that the economy is forecast to grow only 0.1%. That's its slowest expansion since the 98 Asian financial crisis. So how will this new deal be funded?
It's through government, you know, just the kind of government coffers money that's drawn from taxation. The government here is just customarily quite aggressive in how they attack economic slowdowns. If you look back to the last major slowdown in the global financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, South Korea fared relatively well compared to a lot of other countries then, because even though there was a conservative government in power at the time, they enacted this big stimulus plan. And so the government is hoping again that this current round of stimulus will stave off a crisis. But the kind of bigger question is, you know, these one-time issuances of stimulus funds are good in terms of stemming a crisis, but they're not quite the more long-term and the more sustainable solution that the economy here needs. So that's definitely what the president and his advisors are thinking about more broadly.
Stephen, thanks very much indeed. That's Stephen Borowick. Still to come on the programme, the advice given to citizens of the UK is not entirely clear, and many are questioning the official coronavirus guidelines. We'll hear more in just a moment. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Since we're all stuck inside for the near future, why not tune in to Monocle on Culture for a weekly dose of things to read, watch, and listen to. We've been speaking to some of the fascinating people who've written the books, made the music, and directed the box sets that we've been indulging in recently, and they've told us about being creative in quarantine.
How do you produce something that's going to be published after this? Because you're writing into a world that we can't imagine at the moment. What are people going to want to read?
We've also been dialing up our regular roster of critics for their tips that we hope will inspire you too.
It's a party record. Well, it's fun. I mean, the parties that I've been attending recently have had one guest, me. You know, I'd be lying on the sofa listening to a record. I mean, that's as exciting as parties get in the Hodgkinson household right now.
Monocle on Culture airs every Monday at 20:00 London time and is available to download from monocle.com/radio, Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
British MPs are back in Westminster. Some pupils have returned to school. But the UK is divided. The devolved nations of Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland have their own rules. And in England, after a senior government aide, Dominic Cummings, ignored the guidance, there seems little appetite for conforming. Some experts are warning that the end to strict lockdown is premature. Mary Judowski, who is a journalist and former foreign correspondent, joins me on the line now. Mary, is it too soon? I mean, the infection rate in London is way down, but that's not the case across the UK, is it?
No, that's true. But there is a feeling, I think, that with MPs in particular, that as representatives of the people, they have to be in the sort of forefront of the new conditions. And so last week, the government was saying that everybody who couldn't work from home should basically start going back to work. Most schools opened, but without most pupils yesterday. So there is a feeling that if children are being asked to go back to school, workers are being asked to go back to work, that MPs should be going back to the House of Commons as well.
Now, it's a House of Commons in some sort of turmoil, really, and this follows the Prime Minister's top aide, Dominic Cummings, defying the regulations. How much has the scandal over that affected the response to the rules?
That is a big question, which is very hard to determine, because my personal view is that the Cummings scandal, the fact that the Prime Minister's chief aide travelled apparently in contravention of the rules, it's said to be being used as an excuse by some people to say, well, if the Prime Minister's chief aide isn't going to abide by the rules, then we're not going to either. And there's also been a suggestion that maybe some of the relaxing of the rules was introduced maybe just that little bit early to fend off that sort of popular revolt. I'm not convinced how far the Dominic Cummings scandal has actually affected people's day-to-day behaviour, because I think that the lockdown and the restrictions on movement were actually starting to fragment quite a long time before that story broke.
Mm. Given that infection rates aren't equal throughout the country, is there an argument for local areas to impose their own restrictions, as we've seen Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland do?
Well, that's an interesting thing that you talk about. The devolved nations do have different rules. And about 3-4 weeks ago, when it was first talked about possible loosening up, it was regarded as a problem that Scotland in particular wanted to have its own rules. Now that's been rather glossed over. And I think it's seen as, in some ways, a bit of an advantage that there is this possibility to have different rules. But as far as England goes, I mean, as you say, the infection rates and the mortality rates are very, very different, because the virus has sort of progressed across the UK and northwards from the south and westwards from the east. And you can see the way that it's actually risen in those areas, as indeed London has become really very, very free by comparison. But it seems to me that the government is very, very reluctant at the moment to apply any sort of regional distinction. I think there's a feeling that that would be resented in the areas that are currently the most affected. But with the introduction of the tracing mechanism, which is currently sort of at the very beginning and rather controversial, there is, or at least it appears, that there are plans for the government to single out areas which, say, suddenly become hotspots and apply lockdowns to them individually. I'm not sure how that's going to work. I think you could see quite a bit of resistance if it's done on a very local level.
But I mean, night after night, we hear that there's a coronavirus update from Downing Street, the heart of government. We hear how the track and trace program's up and running, how widespread testing's now in place. Examinations of these claims would absolutely suggest otherwise. What is the real situation? It just seems that we hear one thing and then we see a completely different thing. Can this government be trusted?
On track and tracing, it's very, very difficult, because this is, for the UK, I mean, not for somewhere like North Korea or Germany, but for the UK, it is a very new system in relation to this virus. The British say, oh, well, you know, we are actually quite practiced at this because we've used it for a very long time for infectious diseases, say, tuberculosis. But, you know, the incidence of that is very, very small compared with the current virus. So there's a whole new system, masses of people being employed to do the track and tracing. Now, they only came on stream a couple of days ago, so it is actually in its infancy. But there is this gap, and it's not just a gap between the reality of track and tracing, which we actually don't know how effective it's going to be. It is because right at the very, very beginning, the official British line was that they were going to be testing, and you know, they started testing individual cases as people came back from abroad. They were quarantined, they were tested. That lasted very, very little time. When we started getting even above 20 cases a day, it seemed the government did not have the capacity. And the trouble was that the reason they gave for stopping that policy was that, well, they didn't think that it was a particularly useful or effective policy at that stage. The further we've gone, the more we've heard, whether from politicians or from medical experts, it's been, oh, well, you know, the problem was actually we didn't have the capacity to test, which, of course, sets us apart from the countries that have been much more successful at this, Germany and South Korea.
Mary, thanks very much indeed. Here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. The killing of George Floyd, an African-American man whose death has set off nationwide unrest in the US, has been declared a homicide following an official post-mortem examination. Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam has accused foreign governments of double standards in their reaction to Beijing's plans to impose national security laws on the city, pointing to anti-police brutality protests in the United States. In her first public appearance after Washington said it was going to remove Hong Kong's preferential treatment, Lam warned countries threatening actions against Hong Kong may end up hurting their own interests. And Japan's government has approved saliva-based testing for COVID-19, hoping to boost the number of tests being carried out. Japan currently falls behind other industrialized nations in terms of the number of coronavirus tests. Critics say the low rate of testing has made it difficult to trace the virus. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Many of the world's airlines have been cutting routes and staff and requesting government bailouts. But one European low-cost carrier is bucking the trend. Wizz Air is already a major presence in Central and Eastern Europe. It's just announced the opening of 3 new bases, and its new routes present a direct challenge to some of the more established low-cost operators in Western Europe. Our Balkans correspondent Guy Delorne has been a regular flyer on Wizz Air, and he can tell us more. Good morning to you, Guy.
Morning, Georgina.
Now, for those who are new to Wizz Air, what are they all about?
Yeah, I was new to Wizz Air when I first moved to Belgrade back in 2012, and I discovered that they were an easy and cheap way home because they're a low-cost operation based next door to Serbia in Hungary. It's actually the third largest low-cost airline in Europe, but, you know, the destinations that it offers mean that, you know, if you're flying from the UK and you're not going to Central and Eastern Europe, you might not have flown on them before. But it's got 120 short-haul Airbus planes at the moment, with over 200 more on order, would you believe? And typical of many low-cost carriers, they focus on secondary airports. They also claim to be Europe's greenest airline, Georgina. That's thanks to a very young fleet. The planes are 5 years old or so on average. And what you could call efficient loading, that is to say a very lightweight seating and quite closely packed together.
And very low fares, consequently.
Indeed, yes. I mean, I've flown on spectacularly cheap fares with Wizz Air in the past. I seem to remember one was €10 from Larnaca to Belgrade, which I think is a record low for anything I've ever paid for a flight.
Now, they're expanding operations in the middle of a pandemic. How are they proposing to do that?
Yeah, well, they're basing planes at 3 airports, so they're actually turning them into sort of mini hubs. So this is Tirana in Albania, Milan Malpensa in Italy, and the aforementioned Larnaca in Cyprus. And they're claiming that this is going to create hundreds of jobs directly with the airlines, about 100 in Tirana and Larnaca each, 200 in Milan. And then they're saying, of course, the ancillary industries will also benefit as well. And there are dozens of new routes, most of which, and this is why I'm sort of doing this introduction really in a way, I suppose, is they're going to Western Europe, as well as Central and Eastern Europe, which has been the airline's stronghold until now. But it's very interesting that they're clearly looking at sort of EasyJet in particular, because they're also offering flights from the UK through to holiday resorts in Spain and the like. So it's a direct challenge to some of their bigger rivals.
Mm. Why do it now? I mean, have they seen some sort of opportunity within this crisis, or was this always planned?
This is what I was really curious about. I thought, is this something you had planned to happen right now and you're ploughing ahead regardless? Or have you sort of seen that there's an opportunity here? And it's actually a bit of both. They had been planning to expand their network, hence the massive order book with Airbus. But those planes haven't arrived yet. What they do have is their existing fleet, which is less busy than it is usually for obvious reasons. So what they've decided to do is open up the new destinations and the new bases, spread around their existing fleet, and open up these new routes. So it's a real case of taking a crisis and making an opportunity out of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the obvious elephant in the cabin, if you like, is COVID-19. How will Wizz Air deal with that?
Yeah, well, when you look at the new routes, Georgina, they're not starting until July or even August. And the speed at which things are opening up in my part of Europe, which is to say, funnily enough, Central and Eastern Europe, means that I think Wizz Air can be pretty confident that its core destinations, its core market, is opening up rapidly. But there's a bet, of course, there as well that other restrictions are going to be slackening off as well. And the people are going to want to fly. And they are making a big deal of trying to increase confidence of passengers, saying they've got strict hygiene measures in place, no in-flight magazines, masks compulsory. And I like this, what it calls an industry-leading fogging process with an antiviral solution. I have to emphasise that does not take place with the passengers on the plane.
You've flown on Wizz, as you say, many times. What's the experience like?
It's like many low-cost carriers. If you follow the rules, you'll be fine. You know, obviously, Wizz Air, like many others, they will try and upsell a lot of things. They'll upsell your baggage, and they're quite strict about that. So I actually have a bag which I specifically bought to fit the Wizz Air requirements. It's one of those that you can get under the seat in front of you. Otherwise, you're having to pay for a trolley bag to go in the overhead locker. If you stick to those rules, it's absolutely fine. It may not be the most legroom you'll ever experience in your life. The catering offering isn't exactly what you'd call inspiring. But the reason why it succeeded is that it tends to fly at times, prices, and to locations that people want to go to. And if you're willing to trade that for, you know, some creature comforts, then you'll be absolutely fine.
Guy, thanks very much indeed. That's Monocle's Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Well, let's continue with today's newspapers. We're looking at the Australian press today. So joining me is Monocle's contributing editor, Andrew Muller. Good morning to you, Andrew.
Good morning.
Andrew, I absolutely salute you. You have managed to take the day's biggest stories, the race riots in America, and find an Australian angle. Not only that, but you've also got a bit of reality television and romance in there.
I know, this is lovely. All credit goes to Rachel Dexter in The Age for spotting this one. This is exemplary work in the finding local angle to big story technique, beloved of local newspapers, which I suppose The Age just about counts as. In fairness, it ends up, from its somewhat whimsical and bizarre beginnings, being quite an interesting story. It turns out that there is an Australian police officer in Louisville, Kentucky, where there has been a great deal of disturbance. His name is Vadim Dale, and he lives in Louisville because, as you suggested, he met his wife on a reality TV show, Outback Jack, which I can't claim to have watched a lot of at the time, but I think even just from the title, you probably can sense the premise. Anyway, he is now a cop in Louisville, Kentucky, and he has been right on the front lines of this. And it turns out to be an actually really interesting interview about what the reality of this is from the police perspective. And and what it's been like for him. As he says, you know, he began the job, but I quote, "I thought I was one of God's angels doing his work, and now it breaks my heart. That stigma that I'm a racist or a pig when all I want to do is help people is the hardest thing in the world." And he goes on to say about the death of George Floyd, which sparked the current unrest, that "I thought it was disgusting. No one dislikes bad cops more than good cops."
Mm. Andrew, we've seen these protests take off all around the world. Has there been much take up in Australia?
There has been a bit, yes. There's echoes of this story in Australia, i.e. the institutional mistreatment of a minority by police, it directed towards, of course, Australia's Indigenous people. And this has been a recurring, a regrettably recurring theme for many, many decades. So there is a resonance in Australia, and there have been some demonstrations, largely peaceful and largely placid, but I don't think anybody in Australia is attempting to defend what happened to George Floyd, or even attempting to contextualise it, which may be the difference there.
Mm. Right, well, we can't avoid talking about the virus, but this is more of a sort of positive take. Melbourne has been dealing with it particularly well in terms of shops.
Well, Australia has dealt with the pandemic in general very, very well. This is an interesting story that the ABC are running, looking at what's going to happen now to Melbourne in particular. And one of the reasons that Melbourne is such a great city, and one of the reasons it is such a livable city, as Monocle's own annual survey of cities keeps reinforcing, is that whereas many cities around the world have lost their downtowns, they've all been removed from the centre and parked in out-of-town facilities, Melbourne's kept its suburban shopping strips, its restaurants, its bookshops. They're just nice neighbourhoods. And this looks at the future of one of the most famous, which is Lygon Street in Carlton, and worries that it might not come back to what it was. But it's also, and I think this is something we're going to see around the world, it makes the point that Lygon Street was obviously hit hard by the virus. It's all the restaurants and the cafes and the bars, which are only just slowly reopening. But it's making the point that there were problems before then. And I think that's probably what we're going to see around the world, is COVID-19 has accelerated or emphasized problems that already were occurring. Lygon Street, it turns out, already had occupancy problems. There's not as many, the Italian community that fueled it for years isn't what it was. You know, they're facing the same pressures as bars and restaurants and cafes all around the world. And yeah, there's genuine concerns that Lygon Street's glory days may be behind it, which would be a shame, because it is a wonderful, wonderful place.
Mm. Finally, let's have a look at the Canberra Times. There is a town there that I cannot pronounce.
I'll do that for you. This is a lovely Australians conforming to stereotype piece. Canberra is ensconced in a jurisdiction called the Australian Capital Territory. Just outside the borders of the ACT, rather, there's a town called Queanbeyan, which is in New South Wales. New South Wales is reopening at a slightly faster pace than the ACT, which meant that there were more drinking options in Queanbeyan than Canberra. And so somebody at the Canberra Times, Steve Evans is the byline, has had the magnificent idea to actually go to a pub in Queanbeyan and see how many desperate Canberrans are driving over the border for a drink. And to his scarcely concealed delight, he's discovered that people were waiting for the doors to open at 8 a.m. at the Hotel Queanbeyan. At Walsh's, they were there and waiting when it opened at 10 a.m. It's a fabulous story.
It certainly sounds it. Gosh, when is that going to happen here? When will we be able to go to the pub, Andrew?
Are you in a hurry to go to the pub at 8 a.m.? Seriously?
Well, perhaps not 8 a.m. Andrew Muller, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to The Globalist. Well, it's time to talk business now with the broadcaster and financial journalist Louise Cooper. Louise, let's start by looking at the US Congressional Budget Office, because they have issued a pretty dire warning.
So they're saying the hit to the US economy could go on for a year. Now, the Congressional Budget Office is politically independent, so it's quite an important forecast. They're saying it's going to hit economic output by 3%. That's real. And you think, well, that's not a lot. Is it 3% over a decade? Actually, that's $8 trillion. 8 $1 trillion. This Friday, we get the very important non-farm payroll figure. This is the unemployment rate and the amount of job losses for May. And it's going to be quite catastrophic. Unemployment in the States has gone from about 3.5% before this crisis hit to something like 20%. 20% unemployment figure is due to be reported on Friday, which is the worst since the Great Depression in the 1930s. This is an indicator of quite how catastrophic this is going to be. We know, because we get weekly jobless claims, how bad it's going to be, but still, it will be confirmed. But yeah, really quite appalling news on the state of the US economy.
And as you say, this is a non-partisan body.
Non-partisan body. America, Congress has already approved $2.2 trillion of stimulus so far, far quicker than the EU that's still negotiating their package. But the damage done to the economy means that Congress is already talking about another $3 trillion. By the way, the sort of help during the global financial crisis was more like $1 trillion. So it gives you the sense that already America's burned through $2.2 trillion of fiscal help, and it may need another $3 trillion. I mean, the numbers involved are enormous. And you've got to remember, we had, you know, we've got Trump in the White House who'd already cut taxes hugely. America debt position, the country's debt position, is going to deteriorate at an alarming rate. I mean, we've talked about the UK, a budget deficit and debt figures. America is going to be equally as horrendous.
Well, let's look at the public companies there, because they are issuing shares at the fastest rate ever.
So this is a really interesting story, okay? So the stock market in America collapsed, okay, in March. Just fell out of bed. Absolutely massive, huge falls. And then has rallied strongly in April and May. And now we're back to level in the US stock market, not European and UK, by the way, that haven't rallied anywhere near as much. We're now back to a level, we're only like 10% off the highs in America. And there's lots of reasons for that. And I've written a column about that recently in The Spectator. But let's just put that to one side. What is really interesting is it's both a positive and a negative. So the first thing is this big, strong rally has meant that American companies can issue shares and raise money at the largest amount ever. So in May and May alone, American companies raised $60 billion on the American stock market. So that is a really good thing, because, you know, American companies need money to survive the pandemic, and investors have been very willing to give it to them. You know, companies like Carnival Cruise, Southwest Airlines, the kind of companies you would expect to be hit, have suddenly come out and said, we know we need to raise money. So that is a good thing, because that's what capitalism does. Good quality companies need to raise money in desperate times, and they've been able to do so. The sort of downside, that's sort of the positive spin to the story. The negative spin to the story is it tells you the scale of fundraising needed by American companies. So the positive spin is they've been able to raise money, they will survive, everything's great. The sort of negative spin is, well, the fact that they've had to raise $60 billion tells you quite how difficult their financial situation is.
Yeah, and the debt market is following a similar trend.
Yes, indeed. US companies have raised $1 trillion of debt so far in 2020. Again, you can look at it the same way. It's a positive they've been able to raise the money, but it's a negative that they've needed to raise quite so much money.
Yeah. Let's move on now and look at this self-driving startup. What's this all about?
So this is a non-COVID-19 story, Georgina, which I thought we should dip our toe in the water of doing business stories that don't involve the coronavirus, because we haven't done that for 2 months now. So this is, we know the car industry is in crisis, and yet the future is still coming, and it's still coming at us. And one of the things that involves the future is self-driving cars. Now, self-driving cars, getting the technology ready is incredibly expensive. And so we've got Ford and VW tying up with a company called Argo AI, only founded in 2016, already valued at $7 billion. So this gives you an indication of quite how excited people are about self-driving vehicles. And what VW has done is put $1 billion into this Argo AI and folded its own a self-driving business into it. And now you've got VW and Ford each holding a bit of Argo AI, and Argo AI still existing. So you've got an American and a European company getting together, spreading the cost because it's so expensive. And you've got a startup company. The other big players are Alphabet, Google's Waymo, and General Motors Cruise. They have slightly put off the launch date of self-driving cars, Ford has, because coronavirus is really changing the way we're commuting, and they haven't quite worked out how that's working. So this will be very interesting. The real starter to this, though, is in the logistics business, goods deliveries and lorries, rather than us necessarily driving around in a self-driving car.
Finally, Louise, we've got just about a minute or so to have a look at Facebook. This is a really interesting story.
So last Friday, President Trump both tweeted and put a posting on Facebook using the phrase, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts." Now, this is a very emotive phrase, first used by a Florida police chief in 1967 in the Civil Rights Campaign, where American police basically killed black protesters. Now, Trump reused this, and Twitter has decided to castigate him and put a little thing under, not to take the tweet down, but to criticize him. Facebook decided not to. And many Facebook employees think Zuckerberg has done the wrong thing, and they've been protesting using Twitter. And they a number of them walked out, working from home, walked out of work and refused to work as a protest. It's also being reported in the New York Times today that a number of civil rights campaigners met with Zuckerberg last night to say, essentially, Trump's comments stoked violence against protesters, and that Facebook has a duty to do something without it. Unsurprisingly, those civil rights campaigners were disappointed in Zuckerberg's response.
Well, perhaps this might see a mass walking away from Facebook. Perhaps this is the end.
Well, I doubt it, given quite how many people use Facebook, although I'm a bit of an exception. It's interesting. I mean, Zuckerberg said he found Trump's remarks deeply offensive, but they didn't violate company policy. I wonder what does violate company policy.
Louise, thank you. Thank you very much. That's Louise Cooper, and this is The Globalist on Monocle 24. During COVID-19, the Italian version of Vanity Fair, Vanity Fair Italia, has done a remarkable job celebrating the country and the cities affected, such as Milan. The title, which was the first non-English version of Vanity Fair, is published weekly instead of monthly. In recent months, the title carried impressive coverage of what was happening in Italy and, as a result, increased circulation. In the latest issue, the film director Paolo Sarrentino was the guest artistic director. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Simone Marchetti, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair Italia.
I think we are all changed after the coronavirus, and it's something very dramatic and revolutionary. But as always, I always try to see the perspective of everything. And since the beginning, and I asked myself and my CEO and all my team what to do. And I think that a magazine like Vanity Fair, the Italian version of Vanity Fair, has to, first of all, reflect and listen to what's happening. Second, tell stories and information without adding fear, but just clarifying things. At the beginning, all the newspaper in Italy were very dramatic with titles and the front pages. We were like saying, let's low down our tone of voices. We have to be very accurate, very informative, but not emphasize what is dramatic. And then again, we have to change. And so we understood very, very from the beginning that it was not the moment of a celebrity on the cover telling us how difficult it was living with an absent mother or with or doing a childhood in a remote part of the world where you can't realize your dreams. It was not more about that. It was all about, first of all, we did our first different issue was about Milano and the resilience and the character of the city. So we raise up 64 important figures in Milano and some unknown, like nurses or doctors or what else. At that point was very, I mean, revolutionary. We put them all together on a very big cover, and we asked them to celebrate the inner soul of the city in order to be an example for the other. And then we do a second issue. So the second issue was about a lung doctor on the cover from Bergamo. And it was the first time in the history of the magazine that someone known from everybody was put on the cover. But we thought it was very significant because they were fighting front lines. Then on the third issue, ask our one of our most important Italian artists, Francesco Vezzoli, to design the cover and to represent the spirit of Italy, the spirit of a country, not only against the virus, but also for economy, because we are experimenting, everyone is experimenting an economic crisis after the pandemic. Then again, we involve JR, the street artist. Then we ask Oscar-winning director Paolo Sorrentino to direct himself a magazine like it was a movie. And you know what? On one end, it was incredible, and in my opinion, it's a miracle. Each number is growing in the newsstands 70%, 50%, 40%, 60%, which is, as you can imagine, impossible. And it's true. Then the advertising pages and our investors believed so much in the project that they put more money than in the past. I think we will not be better or more eco-friendly or more human or what else after the virus. The virus only put a speed on what was changing and put a speed very, very, very fast. And so we started to change our point of view, even sometimes our way of working, but the DNA is the same. And I think that at the beginning of the Vanity Fair, so 1 year ago, is still the same. It's just adapting to what's going on. And I have to say that, as always, I can count on an amazing CEO, a visionary. His name is Fedele Usai, because he forced us to change and he allowed us to change. This is very important. I'm looking also at the New York Times, who is doing a revolution. I think we all have to do a revolution. So again, we build a network, not only a magazine, that it's working. I hope that it will work in the future, because who knows what's going on in September? Nobody knows. Another lockdown? Do we find a solution to the virus? Nobody knows. But what I can say is that this miracle was possible because we are not afraid to change.
That was Simon Marchetti, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair Italia, speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And for more on magazines, do tune into Fernando's show about print. It's called The Stack, and it premieres every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. It's also available to download on our website, as is our entire archive. That's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Marcus Hippie, Paige Reynolds, Carlotta Rabello, and Daniel Bache. Our researcher was Charlie Filmer-Court, and our studio manager was Sam Impey, with editing assistance from Sean Hickey. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. Fernando is here to guide you throughout the day, and I'll also be with you until midday when it is time for The Briefing with Andrew Muller. And The Globalist will return at the same time tomorrow. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.